This is really a wonderful and a monumental event for us at the Rady School of Management. It's something we're very, very proud of. In a sense, this is certainly one of the very few times that we've had a reunion of really industrial giants from San Diego to come together and to share with this community their thoughts on the past decades in terms of their accomplishments. And again, this is really quite a privilege for us. Again, for those of you who are not aware of this, the Beiser Institute is a very important part of the Rady School of Management, and it's been a part of the Rady School for a number of years now, and it serves a lot of dimensions. One of them is our education and our initiatives and consulting initiatives in employee ownership. Ray Smiler is the director of the Beiser Institute, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Ray, who will then introduce the rest of this evening's session. Ray?
Thank you, Dean. Tonight is a story of how one person, his vision and values, can really affect thousands and thousands of lives, not only in the company he built, but in the ongoing work that he supports. The Beiser Institute is part of the Rady School of Management here at the University of California, San Diego. We became part of the Rady School July 1st, 2004, a great day for us. The Beiser Institute is headquartered here in La Jolla, but we have offices in Washington, D.C., Moscow, Russia, and in the Middle East in Manama, Bahrain, and we work literally in countries around the world. Dr. Beiser set up the Institute because he wanted to promulgate the values and the practices of employee ownership and entrepreneurship, the twin and complementary themes that built a great company and that we at the Beiser Institute have passion to pursue. In our employee ownership work, we work with literally hundreds of companies every year, helping them understand and implement the practices of employee ownership as a way to recruit and retain talent, but more importantly, as a way to inspire and reward those who help build an organization. We think employee ownership is not only the right way to build a company, but a really smart business strategy. You'll hear more about that tonight. On the entrepreneurship side, we're a leading training and education organization implementing programs for entrepreneurs around the world. We have major contracts with the Department of State in 17 countries in North Africa and the Middle East. We do a variety of programs here in the United States, and one of the great initiatives we have now is to work with Rady School faculty and their executive development area to introduce courses on the undergraduate and graduate level and also in executive development. And all of this because the vision and values of Dr. Beiser set this in motion years ago. So our approach is to reflect this vision and values, and tonight we're going to have a discussion about how those vision and values built a remarkable company. The person who will moderate and facilitate this session is a good friend of the Beiser Institute, Tom Dillon. Dr. Tom Dillon has been at SAIC for 18 years. He came there in 1988 from General Atomics. He helped us just recently. We put in a major contract with the U.S. Department of State, and Tom was on the red team that reviewed our proposal, critiqued it, gave us insights, showed us how to score it, and in fact made it a much stronger proposal for us. We're grateful, Tom. Tom, within SAIC, has built major businesses, has worked locally and nationally, and in fact now is making major efforts to contribute to programs here at UCSD, particularly through the engineering school. He has a PhD in chemical physics from the University of Colorado, and before that a degree in chemical physics from Harvard. He's a pretty talented and remarkable guy. Would you welcome Tom Dillon? Tom?
Well, thank you very much. We're very fortunate indeed this evening to have two of the most respected and successful entrepreneurs in the history of San Diego. In fact, from my point of view, their success in building their companies, combined with this great university, is the reason San Diego has become a magnet for high-tech entrepreneurs. We know we owe them a great debt, both of them, but I don't think we really know how much. And we should think about that people like Irwin Jacobs, like Bob Beiser, like Gene Ray, have made San Diego a remarkable place, and so is this great research university, UCSD. I'm not going to go into a detailed introduction of either of these great men, because we're going to do that. That's going to be part of what we're going to get into. There is a serious problem that I'm hoping we can deal. They're both authentically modest. In other words, that it's not an act they really are modest. And that's going to be my greatest challenge, is to try to find some way to get the information out of them when they're modestly referring. My hope is that Gene will help me with Bob, and Bob will help me with Gene. But it's going to be interesting. It's going to be entertaining for sure, and I think it's got the potential to be a great learning experience. We're going to start out. Bob is going to make a few remarks, tell you about SAIC, the great adventure that started in 1969, and tell you a little bit about his book and how he got involved in that. And then we'll ask Gene to stop and to get up and say a few words about his experience at SAIC and then the founding of his own company. Thank you very much. Bob?
Pleasure to be here tonight to tell you about the book, introduce the co-author, Peter Economy. And to discuss how we went about putting the book together, what some of the things that are in the book. And I thought I might start off by telling you a little bit about myself. Of course, we're fortunate to have my good friend Gene Ray here also to participate in this. Gene and I have been through a lot together, and we're still good friends. I thought I might say a word about the factors that motivated top-notch people to join SAIC and take the risk. To begin with, we didn't call it employee ownership at the time, but what we did was to award stock, to sell stock to people based on their performance. If they brought in contracts, they got stock. And we had an algorithm that was constantly changing as the stock became more valuable allowed them to earn the stock. We tried to maintain an environment in which the employee could bid contracts without lots of encumbrances and bureaucracy. They also got options, and there were board seats. Everybody on the board was an employee at the and we tried to keep it that way for quite a long while. Oh, yeah, we also, people were intrigued by the fact that we wanted to work on important company programs that were important to the country. And we call them nationally significant programs. And they always kept that in mind. We didn't want to work on something just to work on something. If you look at SAIC now, about 10% of the employees are here. There's 43,000, 25% in the Washington area, and the rest scattered around the country. I wrote the book because it's a story that needed to be told. Business schools generally are not aware of what can be done by motivated entrepreneurs through using employee ownership to as a big factor in the motivation. Of course, it helps on retention, too. That was how we kept people. They had stock, and they expected the stock price to go up, and it did. So they knew they would lose their stock if they left, so they were inclined to put up with quite a bit of grief before they... Some didn't, but some did. Oh, you may ask the question, wonder why with all these people in Washington, 90% of the business federal, we did not move the headquarters to Washington. The reason is really the San Diego environment is another factor that attracts people. And I certainly didn't want to leave, and neither did a lot of the senior people. So we stayed here, and we've still got quite a large entity in San Diego. Thank you for coming, and I think Gene wants to say something.
As Bob indicated, I joined the company. Actually, I remember the precise date. It was July the 5th, 1970. In fact, I remember the first 3 days at SAI extremely well. I'm sure Bob doesn't. But I was working in Washington in the Pentagon, and came out to work for Bob. And I'll admit it now, although I certainly would not have admitted it then. But I kind of thought I was a hot shot, coming out from Washington to help build this young company. At the time, I think I came in July, and the company was a little over a year old, and I know I'd done $250,000, I believe, Bob, the first year.
Yeah.
And in the year where it did $1.2 million in the second year, so we're just getting into that year. But the first day on the job when I showed up, Bob was tied up, so the secretary told me where my office was, and I walk into my office, and all I can do is just look out the window. I mean, you're looking right out the window down at the Cove in La Jolla. We were in the building. Bob was in the building. First offices. In the building behind George's at the Cove. And so after looking out the building, out the window for a few minutes, I looked around the office. And the only thing in the office was a metal desk, I think it was a used one, and a chair. So I asked, a bookshelf, because I had a lot of books to put in. And they said, well, call the secretary down, down on the first floor. So I called down and asked her to come up, and she let me know that she didn't come up. I came down to her. So I went down, and she told me, yes, you can get a bookshelf. This is the precise bookshelf you get, and you get it from Sears, and here's the number you call. So I called Sears, and sure enough, the next day they delivered a bookshelf, and it came in a box, and it was just a bunch of shelves with rods and screws. And I'm not very mechanically inclined, but I sat down on the floor and spent a few hours putting together the bookshelf and put all my books on it. And then the third day that I remember so well, when I came into work, the bookshelves had broken, the books were on the floor. Now, there was a real lesson that I learned, though, and that lesson was that when you're in a startup company, there are no hot shots, there are no big shots, and there's no job that you don't do. Whatever needs to be done, you do it. And that I learned, pretty quickly at SAIC. And it was a lesson well learned, because it's the way it is when you're starting a company. Another thing I observed very, very quickly was that people – I asked what the working hours were, and they said there are no working hours. You come to work whenever you kindly want to. But I observed that people were coming to work anywhere from 8 to 10 o'clock, but they were leaving also anywhere from 6 to 10 o'clock at night. And not only one, but everyone was working. Bob was working probably the longest hours of anyone. And then that wasn't too surprising, but then I was surprised when everyone showed up at work on Saturday morning and worked until sometime Saturday afternoon. And then, later Saturday afternoon or Sunday, you'd certainly expect to get a telephone call, one or two, from Bob over the weekend about something that was going on, issues that was going on. So I learned another lesson very quickly, and that was that if you're really wanting to get the most out of people, you lead them, don't direct them. And Bob didn't tell us what hours to work, but we were all there long hours working. He was, we were. He didn't tell us how to do our job. He let us know what was expected, but he left it up to us as to how we would go about doing it. We can talk more about that tonight. Another lesson. There were so many lessons that I learned, very early on and all the way through the 11 years that I worked at SAIC. Just a couple I'll just mention, additional ones. Another one was, right off the bat, was how important the customer is. First of all, getting a customer is critical. You don't have a business if you don't have a customer. Or you don't have a business very long if you don't have a customer. So you have to get one. But not only do you have to get a customer, but Bob emphasized from day one, you must satisfy that customer. You must be sure you do the work, do outstanding work, so that you not only have a customer, but you end up having that customer for many years. And so that was another lesson that was learned. Thank you.
Gene, before we get started, I would ask you, though, if you tell us a little bit about your life before SAIC,
okay.
Before that magical 1970.
Sure. I grew up on a farm in Kentucky, outside of a little town called Murray in the southwestern part of Kentucky. Went to undergraduate school at a Murray State University, a local university, and then went to graduate school at the University of Tennessee and got a Ph.D. in theoretical physics. And then I went to work for the Aerospace Corporation, which at that time was located in I was located in San Bernardino, California, for about 2 years, and then I was lucky and got a job in the Pentagon, as I indicated before, and was there for about 2.5 years before I joined Bob at SAIC, and was with him working directly for Bob for 11 years, and then started the Titan Corporation, and we sold Titan. About a year and a half ago, August of 2005.
You arrived when the company was still definitely young and vulnerable, just a little over a year old. What was your perception of the way the company was run to make sure it could grow but also continue to perform profitably?
Well, from day one, it was a very entrepreneurial environment that was created. You know, that you, as Bob said, you were given, you had ownership in the company, and you felt you had that ownership in the company from day one. You also knew from day one that part of your job was to find a customer, as I said before, to bring in business, to bring in a customer. And, you know, when you're young, and I was, I think, 31, I believe, at the time, you know, you're invincible. So I really wasn't worried. I mean, at that time, I think my net worth was just about zero. I had just about paid back the debt from graduate school. So, you know, it wasn't, I don't remember being concerned about the viability of SAIC.
Well, I would like to dive right into employee ownership then, Bob, and maybe you could tell us a little bit more about how you got the idea of employee ownership and how it evolved in the early days of SAIC.
Well, as I said, we were awarding stock to primarily people who brought in contracts, and this worked pretty well for a while. On the other hand, the people who were doing the work and the administrative staff got kind of upset because they were spending the same hours and not getting particularly paid particularly well, so many of them also got stock options and reward for their performance. So some of them ended up being millionaires, it turns out. As the company grew, I had an advisor named Art Beale who worked for the Rand Corporation and then for another entrepreneurial company up in the Bay Area. And he was a very good advisor, but he wanted to take it public. And I had a hard time fighting him because he was a pretty persuasive guy. On the other hand, I didn't do it, and that didn't stop him from helping me. So we continued. I didn't see any reason why we should do any more to get funding. We just keep building the company by awarding stock to people. We didn't call it employee ownership. We just kept building the company. I don't know the date, but we decided that we had a good thing and that we needed to tell the world about it. And one of my advisors was a fellow from the East named Mike Higgins. And in fact, he was an employee. And he said, okay, well, why don't we have a meeting in Congress and tell the House members and the senators how great employee ownership is? So we did that, and it was in the Cannon Caucus Room in the House, I guess, and it turned out that everybody, the whole employee ownership crowd was there, and I hadn't been exposed to them before, and they were very, very helpful. and had some good ideas. And so that's kind of when I began to get the idea that maybe we should call it an employee-owned company, and we actually used to have that on the logo. As I said, we continued to grow using that technique and doing acquisitions. We had enough money to do small acquisitions, and so we didn't really do anything large for a while. Then we had the opportunity to buy a small company called Network Solutions for around $5 million. And they were the registry and registrar for the Internet. And the Internet was just in its infancy, and we were right in the central brain of the thing. As that company grew and more people were registering for domain names, there were only about 100,000 domain names at the time we took it over. We had our hands full because Congress was aware of the fact that this was a monopoly that we had. And I liked it because monopolies can be good, especially if it's your monopoly. So we fought it as long as we could. And after the profits of Network Solutions had gotten to around $100 million, we decided to sell it. And we sold it for $17 billion. This provided us with enough funding so we didn't have to worry about anything. We didn't have to worry about going public. In addition, we took some of that money and acquired Belcore, which was the Bell Arbox, Bell Labs. The Arbox are like VeriSign and whatever it's called. Pacific Bell, I'd call them. We were in that business. They were very profitable. And again, we had decided that working for the Bell Coast was not any fun. So we sold that, made quite a bit of money on that. So again, we had an infusion of resources, and so nobody considered taking the company public until after I left, and then for some reason, the decision was made that the company should go public.
Gene, I think you joined the company, 30 people were in the company, still very early, so you got to see really the development of employee ownership, both as it affected you personally and as it affected your ability to help grow the company. Could you say something about that, employee ownership, from your perspective?
You can't always agree with your boss. And I have to admit now that the not employee ownership. Of course, I loved employee ownership because I was an employee. But I really in the philosophy of it is so sound that there's no argument. I at the time had what I at least thought was conventional wisdom, that a successful company grew up, went public, got liquidity for its shareholders, and everybody made a lot of money. So along the way I think that was the way to do it. And when we started Titan, that's what we did. We took it public when we were only 4 years old. It didn't take me very long after being public for a few years to realize that there is one reason and one reason only, in my opinion, to ever take a company public, and that is that the only way you can raise the capital you need to. Only viable way you can raise the capital you need to grow and build the company is by taking it public and raising the money. Because you don't get much liquidity for the senior executives of any corporation. And so that's a misnomer. And it takes away a lot of it takes up a lot of time, a lot of energy. It takes you away from worrying about customers. So as you grow up, your parents always get smarter as time goes by. Well, Dr. Beister has gotten smarter as time has gone by to me as well, particularly on this topic, because he was absolutely right. all the way along. You should not take a company public unless you really need to raise the capital in order to grow the business.
Well, one of the hallmarks, certainly, of SAIC and I know of Titan was an entrepreneurial spirit. But what in terms of an entrepreneur of actually starting a company, like you, Bob, or like you, Gene, what are the primary skills that are most important to have as an entrepreneur? I mean, there's probably a bunch of future successful entrepreneurs sitting out here. What are some of the, Bob, what are some of the most important
well,
skills?
You have to have an idea. You need to, if you're going to start a company, you need to think up a good idea, talk to your friends, and make sure they agree with you, and figure out nowadays where you're going to get the money to get going. Then decide you're not going to see your wife and family very often. Then decide that you really want to persevere, that you're going to write it out, you're not going to... If you run into difficulties, you'll get advice from Rady School, from the Beister Institute, from a lot of other organizations that are dying to help you, the Small Business Administration. And I also think that you may be able to get funding from the Small Business Administration. So I think these things need to be thought of. Ian may have some other things.
I think you covered it very, very well. Just one additional, thought is that, a good idea, but be sure you have someone you can sell that good idea to.
Oh,
be sure
yeah,
there are customers. again, your point of the customer is the king. Well,
Gene, both companies, Titan and SAIC, have had a heavy emphasis on what you both called entrepreneurial employees. And in some ways, that's an oxymoron. I mean, the entrepreneur is the one who starts up his own company. But how would you describe an entrepreneurial employee, the kind of ideal employee for SAIC or Titan?
Number one, someone that is very smart and sharp in their field. One thing I think maybe to emphasize that we haven't talked about yet I was going to mention this, and I forgot to. When I joined SAIC, I think I was a 32nd employee. And I believe, in talking with Bob a few days ago, that 27 of those 31 other employees had PhDs. I think there were two secretaries, one financial person, and a programmer that did not have. So it was a very high technology company. And I encourage you to get the book, The SAI Solution. There are a lot of things in that book that are not conventional wisdom, like not going public unless there's a real reason for it. Employee ownership and entrepreneurism. But it's not all the conventional things. And one of the things is that the conventional wisdom, I think, again, is that scientists and engineers don't make good managers. And I think Bob and SAIC and hopefully Titan as well prove that technical people can be entrepreneur. They can be reasonably good managers, reasonable enough to build companies. So I think good technical people have the good ideas, but they can also, build the companies. So you're looking for people that are smart, you're looking for people that are dedicated, hardworking, and people that are willing to go out and think out of the box. Find ways to sell their business, make it happen.
You mentioned conventional wisdom. There's a lot of conventional wisdom that says that the founding CEO should stay around a year or two, and then if you want to go to the next level, you need to get a different kind of CEO. Now, you've both defied that in terms of, in Bob's case, taking the company over a 35-year journey to be a Fortune 300 company. What's the secret? Why is conventional wisdom wrong? I mean, you've both proven it's wrong.
Well, in our case, I didn't try to do all the financial stuff myself, and I didn't try to be a lawyer, and I didn't try to be a contracts expert, but I did hire the very best people I could, and they were incentivized like anybody else on a performance basis. And I focused on marketing and also on selecting the programs that we were going to go after, trying to monitor these programs as they were being done, seeing the customers in Washington or wherever. I traveled an awful lot. And so that's...
Gene? No, I think Bob covered it all. Just to emphasize, you know, one of the things is that, again, I learned very, very early at SAIC, and that is to hire the very best people that are and the most, you know, and no matter how senior they are, they're the right person, the good person for the job. You find a way to hire them, and then empower them to do the things that as Bob said, that maybe we're not strong at.
One of the critical roles of a CEO throughout the life cycle of a company is to provide a strong sense of vision and leadership. And Bob, what were the approaches that you tried to use in SAIC to do that, and particularly in such a uniquely decentralized environment?
To be frank, over much of my career, I was not doing much planning in the company. We had a plan that Larry Cull, the first president of the company, put together. And it was a plan that was correct in the dollar estimates that he put down, but what he said we were going to be doing never turned out to be true. We were getting contract. We went where the money was. So the plan didn't help us very much. The banks wanted to see a plan, so we had a plan. And we always met the plan, and we always were profitable. The first year, we made $12,000 out of the $250,000. And I was very surprised. At General Atomic, we never made a profit. That's kind of how we did it.
Gene, you were there on the receiving end of visioning and leadership at SAIC.
Yes, as Bob said, there was no strategic planning. In a formal sense, but in thinking about it, I really think that, and maybe I disagree with Bob a little bit. I think Bob was doing strategic planning all along, all the time, and certainly he provided a vision for the company. And example of that in the late 80s, early 90s, you may remember that. Peace broke out worldwide, and the defense budgets got cut dramatically. During that period of time, if I'm not mistaken, SAIC continued to grow each year as the defense budget got cut by 40%. And I think the reason for that is that Bob was always looking forward and saying, well, now we need to worry about energy. We need to worry about environment. So he would build an environmental group, started building an environmental group, start building an energy group. So I think there was real strategic thinking and certainly a vision for the company that was being provided at all times. Although the formal strategic planning wasn't done. But there was, as Bob said, a very detailed financial plan for the year, put together each year, that we all knew what our plan was for the year. Bob made sure we did.
Well, I'm a moderator, but I'll just say, as a former employee, everybody in SAIC knew where they were going and why. And so it was there was a strong sense of leadership and vision there. Although I'll have to agree with the strategic plan. Both of you are legends of recruiting. Gene, I profited personally from some of your recruiting as a heritage and a legacy. But could you both of you talk a little bit about the role of a CEO in recruiting and retaining not only key employees, but different contacts that are essential for your corporation? Bob, could you?
Sure. The most important asset our company had was its employees. And so I watched very carefully what was going on with the key people. And the minute anybody was disturbed about something, I urged them to come see me, and we'd see what we could do to help them. I spent endless hours recruiting and also trying to keep the staff. There were times when people had submitted resignations, and I found out about it, and I called them at home, and I went to see them and got them to meet me someplace, and I turned many of these people around. I'd say, as young entrepreneurs, it's probably a very important thing to remember that when one of your key people wants to leave, don't accept his resignation. Don't say, well, that sounds like a better job. I never would do that. And if anybody in the company did it, I'd get very upset with them, because we should go after them up to the day they left, and then we should continue to go after them, because very often they've made a mistake, and rather than find another company to go to, they could come back. We held on to their stock was good for a while, so they wouldn't lose their stock for a little while. And so very often people got into the new environment and somebody had sold them a bill of goods, and so they came back. Some people you can't keep. Like, I couldn't keep Gene, and I almost died when he left. But in cases like that, the best thing to do is to go out and hire three more Gene Rays if you can find them.
Absolutely. That's exactly what you always did.
Well, I tried. And you can't lose the business you'll lose some of it because the people that are leaving are really probably pretty outstanding. But you could keep a lot of it, and we succeeded in keeping, I'd say, well over half of the business, which we would have lost otherwise.
Gene, was this a big and important part of your job as CEO?
Absolutely, absolutely. And without a doubt, and I think, Tom, you would say this, and I think almost any senior executive that ever worked at SAI would say this, that Bob Beister is the best recruiter this world has ever known. I don't think there's anyone as good. And so I always tried to emulate Bob in recruiting. But there's one story, I'm not sure whether you'll remember or not, Bob, but on trying to keep people. Back in Washington, I had a group that was working for an admiral on a joint cruise missile program. And there was a captain that worked directly for the admiral, a retired captain that worked for me, that worked was supporting the admiral, and the admiral got unhappy with the way we were organized, and so this guy decided he was going to leave and take his business with him and go somewhere else. So Bob agreed to and went back with me to Washington, and we sat down with this guy at dinner to turn him around so we wouldn't lose the business that he was going to take with him. And that guy he told us what a lousy job we were doing, how terrible it was, because he knew he had this business, you know, he was going to take it with him. Well, it turned out that by Bob going back and meeting and us going into the admiral and telling the admiral how we would change, you know, and to satisfy his concerns, he all of a sudden decided he was going to keep the business at Titan and not give it to that guy who was going to leave. And then that guy immediately changed his mind, of course, and wanted to come back to SAIC. So the last I knew, the guy was still working at SAIC and still had the business.
And we changed things.
Yes, and we changed things. So the admiral was happy with the job.
Could you focus in on any particular high point at SAIC that you had?
Yeah, you'll be surprised at this, but the company got involved in the America's Cup after we lost it in '84, and we were very involved in the design of the cup, and we were almost emotional about how important it was that the U.S. win the cup back. So I think the high point of my time at SAIT was when the America's Cup was won in '87, in Fremantle, and I felt extremely good about that, and I think that it did something else for the company, which was probably long overdue. I had avoided any sort of publicity. I didn't talk to the newsmen. I didn't do articles or anything else. And I met people in that event who sort of said, why don't you come out from underneath the rock, is what they said. And so I did, and found that it really helped us to talk about what we were doing, not be so mysterious about it. We couldn't talk about some programs, but most of what we did we could talk about. So that was really a turning point for the company and a high point in my experiences with SCIC.
Now, Bob, the company had a role in the design of that winning ship.
Yes, they did. It did.
Gene, do you have any particular high points, both at SAIC and at Titan?
I think getting my first contract at SAIC was my high point. It didn't come any too soon. At Titan, I think the high point was, as you will remember, in the fall of 2001, there was the anthrax problem that we had in our country. And it turned out that we had a technology that would sanitize the mail and get rid of and eliminate the threat of anthrax. We were able to take a facility that we had where we had been sterilizing medical products in Ohio and immediately convert that, where the government would send their and big trailer loads of mail, send it up to our facility and run it through the facility so that they were sure that there was no anthrax in the mail for the White House and certain other government buildings.
Before we get into the questions from the audience, do you have any particular advice, again, for the entrepreneurs here, that other than go out and get started, any particular secrets? Because I've challenged them to try to ask you questions to extract these secrets.
Why don't you go first?
One thing we have said, I think, in one way or another, when you do start, first of all, you need to be willing to take risk. And if you don't take... It turns out, I think, in our life, that rewards are proportional to the risk that you're willing to take. And of course, there you can take the risk and it can go the wrong way. But so you do have to be willing and able to take risk to do it. The key thing, though, and I think the key thing at SAIC and I believe at Titan too, was being able to create an environment where you can empower the people in the company to really empower and motivate them to really be highly motivated to do their job, whatever that was. And giving them the empowerment to do it, I think, is key.
Bob, anything?
Yeah, I think that there are a number of things that haven't been said. One of the most important things, I think, is that if you have an idea, don't think you're the only person in the world that ever had the idea. I don't know how many different search engines there have been. And in fact, there's some people here at UCSD came up with a unique search engine. It's pretty obvious Google and Yahoo have kind of got that area covered. But in many, many areas, your idea is the same as somebody else's head. How you find out about what they're doing, the only way you can do it is talk to somebody who knows the business, knows the area, the technical area, and knows it very well, because people are hidden all over the place in this country working on unique ideas. So check, do every kind of search you can to find that there's someone else doing what you're doing. And if they are doing it, that you have a better approach than they have.
What is more important if you have to choose between customers and employees?
uh,
Yeah, that's a
question I've never addressed before.
No. Yeah, I've never had
thank you for giving me a shot to go first, Bob.
The two go hand in hand. I don't know how you solve a customer's problem unless you have a good employee working it. If you have the wrong employee working a particular problem for a customer, then you do need to find the right person to work that problem for the customer and move the employee then to some other job, hopefully where the person is better suited. And often you do have to do that. You do have to find somebody to come in and replace the person that was doing the job. But then you try to find a place for that person somewhere else. And you try to let the person keep their dignity, not lose their dignity in the process of making that change.
I agree with that. Done better.
What you're saying, Gene, is that you need to and can usually avoid having to make a choice between one and the other. You can have it both.
Yeah, but sometimes you do have to remove the remove the employee.
This is for both of you. Are there any key lessons learned regarding acquisitions? What were those lessons?
I think, Bob, I read this in your book, and I certainly agree that I think the thing that causes the most problems in the acquisitions that we did was where the cultures didn't match, where you acquire a company that does business in a different way than what you're doing in your company, then it just makes it very, very difficult to integrate and to have a continuing business. So making sure there's a reasonable match in the way you do business or the culture or whatever you want to call it is I think, the most important. And that's where we made most of our mistakes.
The other thing I would add is that it's very easy to make a financial mistake on an acquisition. The people who are trying to be acquired are not particularly open at times about what's going on in the company. And you have to really dig into the books, audit them, talk to people in the company. If the CEO and president won't let you talk to people, the employees, before you make an offer, then I wouldn't do it, because they're the assets you're buying if they're all... And privately, you need to talk to the employees privately to make sure that there's good morale and that you're not going to inherit a mess. Also, acquiring companies that are losing money. I realize in the biotech area that's impossible to do, but in other areas that's not a problem. I didn't acquire a company that was losing money. I don't think that's a good sign. And even though they have curves that predict ski slope, I think we used to call them. I think that's vital.
Did you ever have second thoughts about employee ownership?
Did I?
Yes.
Oh, I don't think so. I had a feeling that the system we'd put together at SAIC was getting too complicated and that we needed to streamline it, and as you know, we did some things. I think more was desirable, but we used everything we could think of to get stock in the hands of the employees and make it easy for them to afford the stock and not have to mortgage their homes to do it. I never had any reservations about employee ownership.
What were the arguments that you heard against it, though?
Well, I heard that, this thing doesn't make sense. You know, none of the business schools teach it. You're going to run into trouble, or there's a cliff out there. And I remember one of our early board members, a very smart guy named Bill Perry, who was the Secretary of Defense after he left SAIC's board, said, "Well, let's. I don't think this." you know, this is going to work much longer. So we had a smart analyst named Vic Reese who put together a system dynamic model to model this AIC, and you could put into it all sorts of things. You guys are probably familiar with these kinds of models. And, you know, you lose the big contracts, you do this, you do that, anything you could think of. And remember I told you, we had quite a bit of money in reserve, so we couldn't think of anything that, you know, there was any inherent point of failure.
Gene, maybe you can answer this one. Who made the research and analysis that led to the decision-making on your smart acquisitions?
Who did the analysis?
Yes.
It was usually our CFO who would do the analysis for that.
Did you have any bad acquisitions?
Yes. I don't think you can make many acquisitions unless you just have to make some mistakes. And the mistakes that we made, were in almost every case was where the two companies just didn't do business the same way, and it was just difficult to get them to integrated together. Get it integrated in.
The other thing on that, if you have a company or you have employee ownership, you should make sure that the people you're bringing in believe in employee ownership and that they aren't just interested in making money for a few of the senior people in the organization, that they really buy into the employee ownership culture. And if it's not an employee ownership culture, whatever it is, if you're doing an acquisition, it should be sure that that part of the culture is common, you know, something in common.
Yeah, and just an additional comment that I think is very unique to SAIC and to Bob in particular, and that is not only was there ownership in SAIC, but it was very widely distributed. And Bob himself, as time went on, would give some of his stock to key employees. And that's just, I'm not sure that's ever been done before. I mean, this was not giving the corporate, in addition to the corporation, he would use some of his personal stock to reward particular outstanding performance. And to begin with, he only took a small piece of the company as a CEO. But you know, when you end up with a very few percent of an $8 billion company, you're still doing okay. So was the motivation in SAIC, I don't believe, and I don't think anyone ever thought was that Bob's motivation was money. Was to make money for himself. It was to really have a good company, do good work, and grow and build the company. And all the other financial things came as a result of building the company.
Good. Well, I'd like to take a question now. Could you tell us your name? And
my name is Tej, and I'm in the full-time MBA 08 program. When looking for business opportunities, would you recommend focusing on your own area of expertise or let market needs in general drive your search?
Well, I think you should focus on something you know something about.
This next question, I think, is really for both of you. And so maybe, Gene, you could start. What role did product generation play versus contract-based work in the business of Titan?
Yeah. We started out as a service company, and then we got into systems integration, but we were never we never had many products per se. We weren't very successful at building products and just selling a product. We were better at integrating a system and providing a solution than we were at building a product per se.
Bob?
Generally, we did not bid on hardware contracts. It took too much in the way of resources, and we were doing very well in the systems integration business. However, there were a couple of products that came out of our research, and those products are still making money for SAIC. One of the products was the VACUS, which is a device to do non-destructive testing on containers to see if there's explosive in them. So that product is very successful. They're inspecting all the containers that pass through the port of Hong Kong. Everything. And so that product made sense. Other products, including software products, that was one of the things that bothered me at Belcore. Their products were software products. They sold them. And that was a pain for us to do. We just didn't know how to manage that sort of thing, what sort of margin to ask for, how to market them. The other product came from something that technology developed here at UCSD, and this was in the space telescope area. Someone here had invented a image intensifier, which we adopted, commercialized, and put on the satellites to image the Earth, other objects in space. So those specialized technical products were all we were successful with.
One last question. How does an entrepreneur with a technology background expand his network effectively in the early stage of his career?
Why don't you let Gene do that?
Gene?
There are a lot of opportunities for that here in San Diego. A very good place to start would be with Connect. Connect is an organization that started here at the university and now, I believe, is independent of the university, but it is involved with many of the in the biotech area as well as in the technology area. So that would be one good place to start, and they could make a lot of additional introductions.
Great.
Well, I want to thank the audience. I mean, these were terrific questions, and you really did your job. So thank you very much, and I'd like you to join me in thanking these two remarkable gentlemen.